Our first lesson for today is from Jeremiah 8. My joy is gone. Grief is upon me. My heart is sick. Hark, the cry of my poor people from far and wide in the land. Is the Lord not in Zion? Is her king not in her? Why have they provided me to anger with their images, with their foreign idols? The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. For the hurt of my poor people, I am hurt. I mourn, and dismay has taken hold of me. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then has the health of my poor people not been restored? Oh, that my head were a spring of water and my eyes a fountain of tears, so that I might weep day and night for the slain of my poor people. The second lesson for today is from Luke 16th chapter. Then Jesus said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was squandering his property. So he summoned him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Give me an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer. Then the manager said to himself, what will I do now that my master is taking the position away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do so that when I am dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their homes. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he asked the first, how much do you owe my master? He answered, 100 jugs of olive oil. He said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 50. Then he asked another, and how much do you owe? He replied, 100 containers of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and make it 80. And his master commended this honest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. Whoever is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much, and whoever is dishonest in a very little is dishonest also in much. If then you have not been faithful with the dishonest wealth, who will entrust you to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful with what belongs to another, who will give you what is your own? No slave can serve two masters, for a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you. Well, last Saturday, I finally opened up the mail that had come during our trip and realized that on Monday morning, I had to show up for jury duty. And without knowing anything else, that was going to show up in the sermon. But I ended up, I showed up at the appointed time. I waited around. And I ended up being juror number 10 on what was supposed to be a two-day case. It was a case of domestic violence. Did he hit her and choke her or not? There were some interesting dynamics of the case. One that didn't show up but was ever present was the racial dynamic. The man was a black man and the woman was a white woman. And there was a very long history, especially in the United States, of white women calling the cops or calling vengeance upon black men, whether or not they have done something. So now it takes the form of we see everybody calling, all the white women calling the police officers on everybody. But ancient, many, many, many centuries old trope. So that was stressful and on my mind and my heart. It came out, I don't think it was supposed to, that the woman was actively using heroin at the time. So maybe the fights were about that. Both of them were repeat offenders in various ways. And his ex-girlfriend, the mother of his child, came up and testified to him having beaten her before. And he had prior cases, which we weren't supposed to find out about, but somebody mentioned it. And when the cops came to pick him up, he lied and he said he didn't have, or he said he had a different name and that he didn't have his identification on him, which he'd slipped into the car. But why he had his social security card, I don't know. I literally don't even know where mine is. And the first of the two incidents we were considering happened at the kid's birthday party. And so I've been sitting with this throughout this whole week while preparing for this sermon. Jury duty is weird. So much goes in, and other than writing in the notebook they present to you, you're not allowed to get anything out. You can't talk to each other. You can't talk to anyone else. So it's been rumbling and tumbling through me. And while we were waiting, there's a lot of waiting. What's jury duty like? It's a lot of waiting. I was reading through the texts for this week, and they are very difficult texts. The Lucan text is particularly complicated. I don't know if you were confused by that and you thought, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to think right here. Why did you do that? It's set up that way. It's a parable. They're supposed to make you wonder what the heck is going on. And this one comes right after the story of the prodigal son, which we all know and we're kind of okay with. Like we've kind of figured out that one and where it's going. And then we get this story of this master who calls to account his, I call it steward, but manager, they both work. And so we start off in the story, we start off disliking the master. And even though this manager whines and complains, well, I'm too good for begging and I'm not strong enough for actually doing physical labor, which, you know, sounds elitist, because it is. But we end up in the actions that he does, and clearing the records and clearing the roles, we end up cheering on this rogue steward. And so we're against the villain of the master, and we're for this cheating scoundrel of a manager. And then we come to realize at the end that the master praises the cheating steward. And both are wrong choices, and we've just been rooting for inappropriate behavior. It's a lovely little trick played in the form of a story. And it's set up in the explanation afterwards as being about wealth versus God. Are you going to follow wealth or are you going to follow God? And I'd like to, I know we keep getting all of the, I keep getting preaching to you all of the wealth passages. And I changed the scripture, I'm sorry, I changed the sermon title too late this week to have it go in there, but it's, I don't think it's about wealth. I honestly think it's about power. Wealth is the tool of power. And we look at the parable and at this court case wherein money didn't come up, but there is so much of a power dynamic involved. There is in the scriptures, there is the power of the master, there is the power of the steward over those who owe. And then in the court case, there was the power of the really tall, strong man over the woman, and also the power of the woman over the man because of her race, and it ends up being corrupt from all sides. To be clear, I am quite convinced they both beat up each other a lot. But that wasn't what we were supposed to decide. And it is so painful. And we try to find the places of compassion and care, and often we can't. They are missing. It is power struggle upon power struggle. And you think of all the different stories, especially like cinematic and in books. It's just about power. Where is the gentleness, the love, and the care? And then we have this text from Jeremiah, also a very difficult text, because clearly all is lost. They have lost their land. They have lost their king. And the temple, the center of their strength in physical form, is in ruins. And so there is a lament, which is maybe the only good response. Lamentation is a giving up of power, a giving up of influence. It is declaring our woes to God. It is also declaring that we have confidence that God can raise us up and save us from ourselves. It's not giving up on God. It's saying, I believe so strongly in your relationship to us, your covenantal relationship to us, that I will continue to complain and to cry because I'm not leaving you. Don't leave me. Does that kind of make sense? That lamentation is leaning into the relationship as opposed to leaning back. Lamentation does not pick one side. It does not pick a favorite. There is no finding of guilt. It is a different kind of pain. So it's not asking who's at fault. It's just saying, this is terrible. This is really terrible. And it doesn't fall into tropes from stories and from fables. It doesn't try and figure out who's wearing the white hat, who's wearing the black hat. This is just bad. Everything has fallen apart. And in stories, usually we always expect a neat answer. Everything solved in an hour. But real life is complicated. And after a day and a half, my case ended in a mistrial. So there's no solution. There's no closure for anyone because the assistant DA shared too much information. He was losing the case anyways. The struggle is a real one. And the real struggle is to allow power where it is due with God. Not power in other things. Not power in other places. When there is the question asked of who really is in charge and pulling the strings, and I asked this of, he's now our clerk of the denomination, J. Herbert Nelson, but I asked it when he was working in the, I don't know if I asked it, but he said when he was working in our DC offices, so right across the street from, or right across from the Supreme Court, working with members of Congress and all the other areas. When you ask who's really in charge, what's really going on, he says, follow the money. It's not just wealth, it's the power that goes with it. But when the power struggle is gone, then we can see others. When the power struggle between the master and the manager is gone, then we get to see those who are in too much debt, and we get to see more clearly the system that forces them into that. When the power struggle between the couple is gone, then we see the children that are stuck in the middle of the terrible situation their parents and their romantic partners have put them in. When the power struggle is gone between nations, then we can see the people stuck at borders who are pawns in international disputes. We can see the immigrants. We can see the tariffs. We can see the sanctions. We can see the needless wars when we stop paying attention to who is at the top talking the most. When we stop being obsessed with the powerful, the loudest voices, then we can see the real humanity of those who need companionship and help, those for whom those lamentations are real because everything in their lives has fallen apart. My family still don't know what's going to happen to our future. But we have some various possibilities. And if you could pray for me in a job interview in a week and a half, that'd be great. It's working with a community organization that deals with, I think it started with a food bank, and then it moved into various other areas and provides open arms of total care in whatever is needed for those who need assistance in the community. And one of the questions that I've been pondering that they say they're going to ask in the interview is, why are people homeless? Sometimes it's addiction. Sometimes it's mental illness. Those were the situations for my sister. Sometimes it's one more medical bill. Sometimes it is one more house payment that you can't make. It's one more job interview that didn't pan into a job. But we can look at all these little things, and yet we look at the power and we look at the grander scope that says you aren't good enough to deserve being paid more or being cared for better. So we can tittle with all of the little problems, or we can look and see, this is a problem with wealth and with power. And one of the questions they asked is, why do we do what we do? Like, why do we take care of our community members who need help? And I don't even know how to answer the question, because I'm like, 'cause that's what we're supposed to do, isn't it? We're supposed to take care of other people. I literally don't understand the question, because it seems so clear that that is what we as people of faith are called to do. On Friday, you might have heard that the young people walked in the streets. The young people and some others who got to hang out with them walked to bring attention to climate change. And we can sit here and we can ask, how will we help our children save the earth? And I can recycle and I can use different light bulbs. But how are we going to get the corporations that are spewing out 70% of the pollution to change? How are we going to stand up to that wealth, to that power, to that influence, and say, nope, no, I am lamenting the loss of my earth, and I will fight against it? There is This is a bit of a side note, but I'm increasingly passionate about it. So it's been 50 years since the walk on the moon, and so there's been a lot of stuff about space and space exploration lately, on PBS at least, if nowhere else. And at the time, there was the sense of adventure, the sense of finding out about the majesty of the universe. And now when people talk about going to the moon and talk about going to Mars, they talk about mining and how we can get financial benefit from engaging in these space pursuits. What? Why are you doing what you're doing? And then another thing that made me think in this realm this week is how can we save the dignity of people? How can we see those who are struggling and affirm them in who they are? So that feeds into the conversation of homelessness. It feeds into the conversation of dignity for the earth and our natural climate. But I think I've mentioned here before that I like to watch Queer Eye on Netflix. And one of the stars of that show, the one who looks like Jesus, actually, Jonathan Van Ness, has just written a memoir. And the men on the show who are helping others routinely share personal stories of growing up. They routinely share about their childhood and the struggles that they've gone through in order to help the others. And I noticed that Jonathan didn't talk much about his previous experiences. But he's written a memoir, and I think it's because they're some of the most painful and complicated. And he's come out in his stories also as being HIV positive. And so there is sitting with me a question of how can we save the dignity of him and of other people who are dealing with being HIV positive and the ramifications therein. I have a seminary friend who does this work as his job in Baltimore, and he spends his days telling churches to care about people who are HIV positive, and the other half of his days are telling people who are HIV positive that you are still loved. There are still people who love and care for you, because there's such a disconnect. Dear ones, it's not about right or wrong. It's not about who is the hero and who is the villain. The setup of the parable is proven to be a false one and full of distractions. Where we are called as believers, where we are called as people and actors of faith, is towards love, towards compassion, towards praise of God, giving the power to God. We are called to lament. It sounds like we shouldn't be, but we are, to say, God, this is not right. Stick with us, please. We are called to lives of devotion, and we are called to lives of grace and forgiveness. Not dichotomies, not power. We are called to justice, which the best way I can describe it, I haven't come up with anything better. We don't imprison people for stealing bread. We figure out how no one needs to steal bread in the first place. We change the power dynamic. We are called to lives of righteousness, right relationship. Not in terms of power or influence. We are called to walk with God, which turns all of our human misperceptions on their heads. And it's hard, and it's good, and it's worth it. I said that, Andrew picked up on that last time. This life is worth it. Don't look for the hero. Don't look for who to cheer on. Look for who to lift up and love. And you will be lifted up and loved too. Thanks be to God. Amen.